Greetings, everyone. My name is Charles Marsh, and I'm a member of the Department of Religious Studies here at UVA and director of the Project on Lived Theology. It is my great pleasure to welcome you to the 2009 CAPS Lecture in Christian Thought. I am grateful for your presence here tonight and look forward to a fruitful time together. Before a proper introduction, may I ask that you turn off all of your cell phones? I'll do the same. I'll be the lead. I also wanted to note that tonight's lecture will be recorded and will be available on the project website in a week or two. Professor Rabiteau was kind enough to speak to my graduate seminar this afternoon, an extraordinary session on an essay called A Hidden Wholeness, Thomas Merton and Martin Luther King Jr. And that conversation will also be on the website in the next 2 weeks. The CAPS Lecture is an annual lecture made possible through the generosity of Dr. Jerry and Mrs. Catherine Capps of Atlanta, Georgia. The series provides a forum for prominent theologians and scholars of religion, both from the United States and abroad, to address issues of faith, meaning, and public life. Tonight is our sixth annual event, and we are pleased this year to be working in partnership with Theological Horizons and with the Carter G. Woodson Institute. And my thanks to Professor Deborah McDowell for helping build a bridge between tonight's lecture and the Institute, which she directs. I am delighted to introduce to you the 2009 CAPS Lecture, Albert J. Rabiteau, the Henry W. Putnam Professor of Religion at Princeton University, and one of the most influential and creative voices in contemporary American religious thought. His research and writing have focused on Catholic American history, on African American religious movements, on faith and culture, and recently on religion and immigration issues. The title of tonight's lecture is Holy Ordinary, Locating the Sacred in Literature and Life. And over the next hour and 15 minutes, Professor Rabiteau will explore with us how contemporary fiction often provides and displays the holy or the sacred in unexpected and surprising ways, and how the holy and the sacred appear often in the quotidian mysteries of everyday life. In his talk, Professor Rabiteau will also examine the theology that underlies the holiness he has discovered in his own life as a teacher and a scholar. Albert Rabiteau is a native of the Mississippi Gulf Coast and grew up in Michigan and California. He graduated from Loyola University in Los Angeles and continued his studies in English literature in the Graduate School of the University of California at Berkeley. After receiving a master's degree from Berkeley, he studied Roman Catholic theology at Marquette University and later finished his PhD in religious studies at Yale, writing a dissertation on the religious life of slaves that would establish a new paradigm for the religious and theological interpretation of African-American religious history. After his graduate years, Dr. Rabiteau taught at Xavier University in New Orleans, Yale, Berkeley, Harvard, and since 1982 at Princeton University, where he has chaired the religion department and served as the dean of the graduate school. Among his numerous books are Canaan Land, A Religious History of African-Americans, Fire in the Bones, Reflections on African-American Religious History, Religion and Immigration, Comparative and Historical Perspectives, and Slave Religion, The Invisible Institution in the Antebellum South, which 30 years after its publication is widely celebrated as a classic in the study of American history and religion. Professor Rabiteau is also the author of A Sorrowful Joy, A Spiritual Journey, a beautiful and haunting memoir in the tradition of such spiritual memoirists as Thomas Merton, Henry Nouwen, Patricia Hampl, and Kathleen Norris. It's a lovely and wise book written with the generosity of an honest searcher who braves the inner journey with a willingness to find forgiveness and reconciliation in the broken places of history, of his own and of ours. Finally, Al, I want to say how grateful I am personally to you for your courageous and luminous work as I have made my own way from a childhood on the Gulf Coast through doubt and guilt and eventually to the strange world of academe. Your journey of passing over and returning home, the journey to self-knowledge through empathetic intuition, as you have written, has been a guide to me like a lantern illuminating a way forward, and I know you have for many others here tonight. So thank you very much, and thank you for accepting our invitation.
Good evening. Thank you, Charles, for that generous and eloquent introduction. Thanks to the CAPS family for the generous support that makes this lecture series possible. Thanks to Charles for the invitation to join the distinguished list of speakers who have preceded me. Thanks to Professor Deborah McDowell for jointly participating in this event. Thanks to Christina Garcia-Wade, the project manager of the project, and Live Theology for making the arrangements that made this visit possible. And thank you for coming tonight, and I look forward to the opportunity to have some discussion at the end of my lecture. The Holy Ordinary, locating the sacred in literature and life. Mr. Head, an uneducated elderly white grandfather in the rural South, decides to take his young grandson, Nelson, for his first visit to the city. The relationship between the two has degenerated into a state of constant antagonism and petty competition. Arrived in the city, they begin to see the sights, bickering all the while, until they get hopelessly lost, each blaming the other for their plight. Eventually, they stumble upon a sight neither has seen before, a weathered plastic figure of a Negro sitting bent over on a low yellow brick fence. Their encounter with this woebegone object they describe as an artificial nigger astonishes them both and leads grandfather and grandson in Flannery O'Connor's short story of the same title to a religious epiphany that transforms their lives and renews their relationship. O'Connor's location of the holy and the unlikely figure of a racist artifact is one example of many in which the sacred emerges out of the mundane within her fictional geography of a Christ-haunted South. Moreover, the narratives of several other important 20th century authors, such as William Faulkner, George Bernanos, James Baldwin, and Walker Percy, and those of some contemporaries such as William Trevor, Mark Saltzman, and Marilyn Robinson, intimate the presence of the numinous within daily life in their short stories and novels. These literary works offer an alternative and often surprising mapping of the location and the meaning of sanctity, religion, and the sacred in the daily events of fictional characters' lives, exemplifying the insight of the 20th century French poet Paul Eluard, who once wrote, "There is another world, but it is within this one." The Artificial Nigger is one of several kind of stories assigned in a seminar class I currently teach at Princeton. In the course called Holy Ordinary, the Sacred and Contemporary Fiction, 10 undergraduates and I read and discuss novels and short stories in which the sacred emerges out of day-to-day circumstances in surprising ways. It is unusual for me to teach a course in literature, since most of my research and writing has been historical. Late in life, I am enjoying the opportunity to return to the field in my first academic study. As Charles said in his introduction, I majored in English in college, and I gained a master's degree in English literature in my first stint in academics, graduate school. Returns, recollections, retrospectives loom large in my life these days as I approach retirement, which I anticipate as a major transition. The end, or at least the diminution, of an activity that has defined my life, my status, and my identity for 42 years. It seemed fitting then to me, as I approach this milestone, to use this particular occasion as an opportunity to reflect upon the meaning of my life as a teacher and scholar, not merely autobiographically, but as a way of examining from my perspective the meaning of lived theology, hoping that my experience may be meaningful to you. As the old adage says, those who can't do, teach. I remember how those words troubled my conscience during my graduate school career in the late 1960s, when I worried in those activist times whether I ought to be a community organizer instead of studying to be an academic. I would have been a horrible community organizer, by the way. Over the years, I've perennially needed to remind myself that, after all, teaching is doing, as I discovered during my first full year of full-time teaching at Xavier University in New Orleans in 1968-69, a tumultuous year politically and socially in which I taught theology courses to several classes of undergraduates and discovered that teaching, reading books, exchanging ideas about important matters with bright young minds, was my vocation. But what kind of doing is it, and how is it related to my life, in my life, to theology? Rather than trying to answer these questions abstractly, I will offer concrete examples by discussing some significant passages drawn from several novels and short stories that we read in the course Holy Ordinary. I will attempt to explain how the moral values, theological implications, and religious assertions articulated in the text I have chosen to share with you tonight resonate with my life experience, influence my religious sensibility, and inform my career as teacher and scholar. Of course, the topic of the course and the title of this lecture already reveal more than a hint of my answer. Relinquish. William Faulkner's The Bear forms the long central chapter in his novel of linked short stories, Go Down Moses, published in 1942. A story about an annual ritual hunt for Old Ben, a legendary bear in the wilderness, the big woods, bigger and older than any recorded document. That doomed wilderness whose edges were being constantly and punily gnawed at by men with plows and axes, who feared it because it was wilderness. Literally, Old Ben was a big old bear with a one-trap ruined foot that in an area almost 100 miles square had earned for himself a name, a definite designation like a living man. Symbolically, he was a phantom, epitome, and apotheosis of the old wildlife, the old bear, solitary, indomitable and alone. The hunt is a yearly pageant of the old bear's furious immortality, as the hunters were going not to hunt bear and deer, but to keep yearly rendezvous with the bear, which they did not even intend to kill. Here we are in ancient ritual ground. Introduced to this ritual pageant of the hunt, Ike McCaslin entered his novitiate to the true wilderness with Sam beside him. It seemed to him that at the age of 10, he was witnessing his own birth. Sam is Sam Fathers, son of a quadroon slave and a Chickasaw chief. Sam is Ike's father figure and mentor in the ways of the wilderness and the craft of the hunt. It is not accidental that he is the descendant of the first occupants of the land, and of those who were brought as slaves to work the land, and of those who came to take possession of the land. Ike has already learned the necessary humility to be a hunter, and he would learn the patience. He knows that he will not shoot the bear, but he has seen the bear's fresh tracks, and Sam has told him that the bear has seen him. He senses a mystical connection and yearns to see the bear. But there remains an obstacle, something he needs to do. He had already relinquished of his will because of his need in humility and peace and without regret. Yet apparently that had not been enough. The leaving of the gun was not enough. He stood for a moment, a child, alien and lost in the green and soaring gloom of the marshless wilderness. Then he relinquished completely to it. It was the watch and the compass. He was still tainted. He removed the length chain of the one and the loop thong of the other from his overalls and hung them on a bush and entered it, emerging suddenly into a little glade in the wilderness coalesced. It rushed soundless and solidified. Then he saw the bear. It did not emerge, appear. It was just there, immobile, fixed in the green and windless noon's hot dappling. Not as big as he had dreamed it, but as big as he had expected. Bigger, dimensionless against the dappled obscurity, looking at him. Then it moved. It crossed the glade without haste, walking for an instant into the sun's full glare and out of it, and stopped again and looked back at him across one shoulder. Then it was gone. It didn't walk into the woods. It faded, sank back into the wilderness without motion. Let me highlight several features in this passage for our consideration. The primal wilderness of which the bear is the apotheosis is a doomed wilderness, threatened first by the puny efforts of farmers to clear land, and later by the much more devastating effects of logging companies and railroad clear-cutting, a devastation all too familiar to us who have, as Joni Mitchell put it, paved paradise, put up a parking lot, in our seemingly inexorable plunge toward environmental catastrophe. On the contrary, Ike's attitude toward the wilderness and the bear is one of reverential awe. He has relinquished any will to control. It is relinquishment of force, control, and power, represented by the gun, and a sense of direction, represented by the compass, and predictability, symbolized by the watch, that allows Ike to relinquish himself to the wilderness and so see the bear. It is relinquishment that allows Ike and us to relocate ourselves within primordial nature, our natural environment as creatures. What do we need to relinquish in order to align ourselves with the sacred in nature? Note the qualities that precede relinquishment. Relinquishment in Ike's case are humility and patience. To relinquish any desire to control, as Ike learns, requires patient listening and intense attention. The ability to totally yield oneself to nature. Perhaps this passage speaks to me so powerfully, because it reminds me of the ways in which nature spoke to me as a boy, about the same age as Ike, when a much reduced patch of wilderness served as my playground and inspired in me feelings of enchantment, of being taken outside of myself in moments of transcendence. Over the years, rambles in nature have remained crucial respites in my life. Daily walks in the woods down by the lake where I live offer graced encounters with great blue heron, changes of the seasons, the murmur of streams rushing over rocks, the brilliant sparkle of sun on the surface of water, the weird song of the lake breezing, occasions of sheer delight in the wonder of the world. I experience the healing power of being immersed in the beauty of nature. Some days I am capable of apprehending and appreciating the whatness of things, the quality that the poet and Jesuit priest Gerard Manley Hopkins called inscape. A theology of wonder at a world charged with the glory of God, which I find compelling, was articulated by St. Maximus the Confessor, in the 7th century. It is, according to Maximus, our vocation to perceive the presence of the Logoi, the siege of truth, in the world, and to offer them back to God in a cosmic liturgy of creativity. The capacity to apprehend the Logoi, which he called theoria physicae, natural contemplation, is dependent upon the attitudes Ike learns from Sam Fathers. Waiting, patience, attentiveness, stillness, and relinquishment of the will to control or predict. It is the act of contemplating God in and through nature. The contemplation of nature, according to Maximus, finds its starting point in man's complete immersion in the natural world that surrounds him. He is nourished by that world in two ways, bodily by what it produces, intellectually, spiritually, by the seeds of truth that the Creator has planted in all things. It is the reception of the mysterious, silent revelation of God in his cosmos, by which we see the inner meaning of things and regulate our entire lives according to the norms hidden in things by the Creator. By natural contemplation, we're able to unite the hidden wisdom of God in things with the hidden light of wisdom that exists in ourselves. Natural contemplation implies a sense of community with nature. The tendency in our modern technological view of nature is to exploit and manipulate things with a deliberate indifference to their logoi, an indifference based in our desire to make nature serve our own immediate interests. The craft of teaching and the craft of writing, like the craft of hunting that Ike learned from Sam Fathers, require a set of skills, including relinquishment of power, control, and predictability. Zayat Age Seminar has become my preferred form of teaching, though it produces more anxiety for me than lecturing, precisely because I have less control. Seminars are, by definition, collaborative ventures involving spontaneity, improvisation, and close attentive listening, alert to the possibility of inspiration. Similarly, the craft of writing involves learning a set of skills that include facing patiently the empty page waiting for the mysterious bear to appear. Writing requires me to empty myself of the pretense that I can force things to happen. I am taken outside of myself in the process of creating a narrative. Indeed, I strive to achieve a writing style that effaces my ego in order to reveal the subjects of my narrative and to welcome readers in to appreciate the significance of those I write about. The bear is about the land and our place in it. A grown-up, Ike argues with his older cousin, McCaslin Edmonds Cass, about the moral and religious meaning of the history of the land and those Indian, African, and European peoples who have dwelled on it. In this long, convoluted debate, ranging across the history of the American South, from encounter, settlement, the Civil War, the failure of Reconstruction and its aftermath, marshaling and dismissing biblical arguments, McCaslin contests Ike's decision to relinquish his inheritance as idealistic, self-centered, and irresponsible. But for Ike, their family has been irrevocably tainted, cursed by the evils of slavery, including the miscegenation, rape, and incest committed by its founder, his and McCaslin's grandfather. Ike, like the bear, remains a solitary figure without progeny, emotionally detached from the history of his people on both its black and white sides. As an old man, his black niece confronts him with a haunting accusation in the form of a question. Old man, have you lived so long and forgotten so much that you don't remember anything you ever knew or felt or ever heard about love? Ike McCaslin, in the sense of principle, has relinquished community. The text to which I turn next reveals the ongoing effects of the curse of slavery on the lives of the descendants of slaves, the people of whom Faulkner wrote, "They endure." A spiritual aristocracy. James Baldwin's first novel, Go Tell Her on the Mountain, perhaps Baldwin's counterpoint spiritual to Faulkner's Go Down Moses. I imagine choir of two, one of them Faulkner singing, go down Moses and the other Baldwin singing, go tell it on the mountain. This first novel of Baldwin's focuses on one day in the life of John Grimes, a black adolescent in Harlem, who seeks to escape the squalid tenements, the racial oppression and poverty of his people, and the corrosive bitterness of his stepfather. His scholastic ability is praised by his white teachers and promises education as a way out for John. On his 14th birthday, John is cast down upon the dusty floor of a sanctified church, astonished under the power of God. There he experiences the rebirth of conversion. Like Ike McCaslin, John Grimes undergoes an initiation ritual, but one of a different sort. Prostrate on the threshing floor, he struggles desperately to flee as an ironic voice urges him to get up, since he doesn't belong in this company of niggers. But the more he tries to flee, the deeper he falls into the darkness and the greater his terror. Ah, down, what was he searching for here all alone in darkness? But now he knew, for irony had left him, that he was searching for something hidden in the darkness that must be found. He would die if it was not found. Or he was dead already and would never again be joined to the living if it was not found. Encircled by the prayers of the saints, which is the title of the middle section of the novel, section devoted to the lives of John's aunt, stepfather, and mother, John undergoes a terrifying and liberating experience that is simultaneously a conversion experience and incorporation into the history of the church. In the stories of John's immediate family told in flashback, Baldwin encapsulates the history of black Americans from the post-emancipation rural South to the late 1940s urban ghetto of the Great Migration North. Shadowed by racial oppression and violence from without, the lives of John's people are riven from within by jealousy, pride, misunderstanding, and failure to love. Their stories come to a focus upon John as he is struck down by the Spirit. He falls not only under the weight of sin, but under the burden of the accumulated history of suffering inflicted upon his people. John is claimed by a spiritual force that pushes him onto an archetypal journey across an ancient landscape populated by prophets, apostles, and martyrs. In his trance, he confronts an army of people. Puzzled, he comes to understand whose company it is that he seeks so desperately to flee. They are the armies of the night, the rejected, the outcasts, the wretched of the earth. And he is in their company. There is no escape. Suddenly their suffering becomes a sound he has heard all his life, but it was only now that his ears were opened to this sound. It came from darkness that could only come from darkness, and yet bore such sure witness to the glory of the light. This sound John not only recognizes, but now internalizes. Now in his moaning, and so far from any help, he heard it in himself. It rose from his bleeding, his cracked open heart. It was a sound of rage and weeping which filled the grave, rage and weeping from time set free, but bound now in eternity. Rage that had no language, weeping with no voice, which yet spoke now to John's startled soul of boundless melancholy, of the bitterest patience and the longest night, of the deepest water, the strongest chains, the most cruel lash and most bloody, unspeakable sudden death. Yes, the body in the fire, the body on the tree. He struggles to escape, but he finds no escape. And in his fear, John calls out to the Lord for mercy. And he saw before him the fire, red and gold, and burning in the night eternal and waiting for him. He must go through this fire and into this night. Then John glimpses for a moment only the Lord, and the darkness for a moment only is filled with a light he could not bear. And in that moment he was set free. The light and darkness had kissed each other and were married now forever in the life and the vision of John's soul. As Baldwin well knew, the conversion experience was a major method for initiating young people into the community of African American believers for generations. A deeply personal experience of direction, orientation, and validation. Conversion involved a profound appropriation of the biblical narratives. convert's life became sacralized by casting it against the backdrop of the biblical stories of struggle between God and evil. The resonances of this sacred drama upon the daily conditions of the rest of their lives was incalculable. A deep internal experience of transformation defined their identity and self-worth. The conversion experience, rooted deep within the convert's psyches, an abiding sense of personal value and individual importance that grounded their identity in the authority of God. They knew that they constituted a spiritual aristocracy who did not simply talk about God's word, but experienced its power on the altars of their hearts. John Grimes, grounded in the history of his people's suffering and endurance and transcendence, now knows that no man can strike down his soul. He achieved his own authority, and that is unshakable. He has been transformed not by fleeing his people's history, but by identifying with that history, by permitting himself to be grasped by it. And in being grasped, engulfed by that company of suffering, he comes to comprehend the paradox that is precisely the election of the earth to the chosen ones of God. He finds himself in their company, joining the long lines of the prophets, martyrs of biblical tradition. Complementing then the earlier vision of the suffering, violent, and bloody history of Black Americans, now comes another vision of a history of suffering and triumph of those who have gone before. No power could hold this army back. No water dispersed them. No fire consumed them. One day they would compel the earth to heave upward and surrender the waiting day. They sang where the darkness gathered and where the lion waited and where the fire cried and where the blood ran down. No, the fire could not hurt them. And yes, the lion's jaws were stopped. The serpent was not their master. The grave was not their resting place. The earth was not their home. Job bore them witness, and Abraham was their father. Moses had elected to suffer with them. Shadrach, Meshach, and Abednego had gone before them into the fire. Their grief had been sung by David, and Jeremiah had wept for them. Ezekiel had prophesied upon them, these scattered bones, these slain. And in the fullness of time, the prophet John had come out of the wilderness, crying that the promise was for them. They were encompassed with a very cloud of witnesses, and they looked unto Jesus, the author and the finisher of their faith, running with patience the race he had set before them. They endured the cross, and they despised the shame, and waited to join him one day in glory at the right hand of the Father. On one level, Hotel on the Mountain is the story of John Grimes' conversion. On another, it is the meaning of African-American history. What is to be told on the mountain is a lesson that salvation lies not in the high road of the proud and the mighty, but with the poor, the suffering, and the wretched of the earth. Not merely because they suffer, but because suffering can be transformed into a source of wisdom and strength, maturity, authenticity, and integrity. African-American Christians believed they were a chosen people, not because they were Black, nor because they suffered, but because their history fit the pattern of salvation revealed to them in the Bible. They saw themselves in Christ, the suffering servant. Their lives modeled the paradoxes of the gospel. In weakness lies strength, in loss, gain, and death, life. The conversion experience of Black Christians grounded their identity in the knowledge that they were accepted by God. Indeed, that they were of ultimate value in the eyes of God, no matter what white men thought. The communal experience of worship, epitomized in the preaching, praying, and singing of generations of Black Christians, created and recreated their identity as a chosen people, another Israel amidst this American Egypt. In the ecstasy of worship, this identification became dramatically real and supported their communal identity as especially divinely chosen people, in stark contrast to the ubiquitous racism depicting them as inferior to whites. Conversion and worship nurtured the capacity of the human spirit to transcend bitter sorrow and to resist the persistent attempts of evil to strike their spirits down. As Faulkner indeed had observed, they endured. But as Baldwin attests, they more than endured. The resonances of this passage for me lay in the recovery of my own people's history, shadowed by racism and violence, a history that has been formative on my life and my work. I came of age in the academy in the 1960s and 70s, a period of the development of African-American studies. The inclusion of African-Americans and other previously invisible groups in the history books was an extremely important development, not just for academic study, but also for the understanding of ourselves as a nation. For history functions as a form of self-definition. In its pages, we read ourselves. It tells us who we are because it reveals where we come from and where we've been. The neglect of black history not only distorted American history, but also distorted both white and black Americans' perceptions of who we are. As I sought sources to work on the history of the religious lives of slaves, I became fascinated by the voices of former slaves, preserved and narrative accounts of their lives, not simply as historical evidence, but as voices that seemed to speak directly to me. These voices were special. They rang with the authenticity of those who had endured the suffering and triumphed over it. In my dissertation in the book Slave Religion, that succeeded it, I tried to capture the tenor, the rhythm, and especially the wisdom those voices conveyed. The core of what they conveyed was succinctly captured in the words of Howard Thurman in his profound meditation on the spirituals, Deep River. By some amazing but vastly creative spiritual insight, the slave undertook the redemption of a religion that the master had profaned in his midst. Despite severe persecution and suffering, slave Christians bore witness to the Christian gospel, whose truth they perceived and maintained in contradiction to the debasement of that gospel by those who held power over their bodies, but not their souls. The suffering witness of these slave Christians constitutes a major spiritual legacy, not only for their descendants, but also for any who take the time to heed their testimony. A basic underlying premise of my work is that we have need of their voices. We need to hear and listen to the stories of all of our ancestors. We need to be informed by the memories of their lives. Memory, story, ritual are all ways of remembering a community broken by hate, rage, injustice, and fear. Not to avenge, nor to make up for what can't be undone, but perhaps to heal. I remain convinced that if we listen to the stories of others, we will be intrigued by the drama of their lives, moved by their poignancy, and finally surprised at the common humanity that lies beneath their distinctive details. In the end, what we hold in common is a set of shared stories. If we see commonality, we will discover it in the telling and listening to each other's stories. Confident that an adequate history of the various races, ethnicities, and religions that came to dwell on this land will reflect our continually expanding American identity. Flannery O'Connor's story, The Artificial Nigger, with which I began, offers a striking symbol of the heaving power of the African-American experience, converging with Baldwin's vision in Goatell on the Mountain. It was not possible to tell if the artificial Negro were meant to be young or old. He looked too miserable to be either. He was meant to look happy because his mouth was stretched up at the corners, but the chipped eye and angle he was cocked at gave him a wild look of misery instead. Nelson and Mr. Head stood gazing at the artificial Negro as if they were faced with some great mystery, some monument to another's victory that brought them together in their common defeat. They could both feel it dissolving their differences like an action of mercy. My next text, selected from another story by Flannery O'Connor, deals with one of the more intransigent and deep-seated barriers to communication, reconciliation, and community. Who do you think you are? Flannery O'Connor's story, Revelation, is a story about Mrs. Ruby Turpin, a 47-year-old Southern Christian woman. Sure, she's saved and thankful to Jesus for not making her a nigger or white trash or ugly. The story opens with Mrs. Turpin surveying the doctor's waiting room that she and her husband Claude have just entered. Claude has an injured leg that needs attention. The Turpins own land where they raise cotton, harvested by black workers, keep white-faced cattle, and raise pigs. Their pigs, Mrs. Turpin testily explains to a white trashy woman, are not dirty since they live not in a pigsty but in a pig parlor, where their feet never touch mud but only concrete. Besides that, Claude hoses them down every afternoon. Mrs. Turpin is puffed up with pride in her own virtue. To help anybody out that needed it was her philosophy of life. She never spared herself when she found somebody in need, whether they were white or black, trash or decent. And of all she had to be thankful for, she was most thankful that this was so. Meanwhile, another patient waiting to see the doctor, a young Wellesley college student, has been eyeing Mrs. Turpin since she entered the room. The significantly named Mary Grace has got Mrs. Turpin's number. Her blue eyes appeared alternately to smolder and to blaze. The girl's eyes seemed lit all of a sudden with a peculiar light, an unnatural light, like night road signs give. Mrs. Turpin has the uneasy feeling that she is looking at her as if she had known this doctor all of her life. All of Mrs. Turpin's life, it seemed, too, not just all the girl's life. As Mrs. Turpin waxes on about how grateful she is for what Jesus has made her and what he has given her, she gets carried away with joy and cries aloud, "Oh, thank you, Jesus, Jesus, thank you." At that instant, a book hurled by Mary Grace from across the room, titled Human Development, hits Mrs. Turpin directly over her left eye. Then Mary Grace hurls herself at Mrs. Turpin and begins to throttle her. After Mary Grace is subdued and sedated, Mrs. Turpin recovers enough to confront her attacker. Leaning forward until she was looking directly into the fierce, brilliant eyes. There was no doubt in her mind that the girl did know her, knew her in some intense and personal way, beyond time and place and condition. "What you got to say to me?" she asked, hoarsely, and held her breath, waiting as for a revelation. The girl raised her head, her gaze locked with Mrs. Turpin's. "Go back to hell where you came from, you old warthog," she whispered. Her voice was low but clear. Her eyes burned for a moment as if she saw with pleasure that her message had struck its target. Back home after this traumatic event, Mrs. Turpin lay down to recuperate. But rest was impossible. The image of a razorback hog with warts on its face and horns coming out behind its ears snorted into her head. She moaned a low, quiet moan. "I am not," she said cheerfully, "a warthog from hell." But the denial had no force. The girl's eyes and her words brooked no repudiation. She had been singled out for the message, though there was trash in the room to whom it mercilessly had been applied. The full force of this fact struck her only now. The message had been given to Ruby Turpin, a respectable, hard-working, church-going woman. The tears dried, her eyes began to burn instead with wrath. Mrs. Turpin then allows full vent to self-justification, self-righteousness, and wounded pride. Incensed, she challenges God. "Why me? There's no trash around here, black or white, that I haven't given to, and break my back to the bone every day working, and do for the church. How am I a hog?" she demanded. "Exactly how am I like them? If you like trash better, go get yourself some trash then," she railed. "You could have made me trash, or a nigger. Go on, call me a hog, call me a warthog from hell. Put that bottom rail on top. There'll still be a top and bottom." A final surge of fury shook her, and she roared, "Who do you think you are?" And then, as she does frequently, Connor describes the natural surroundings as if they were a heavenly chorus, commenting on the action of the drama. The color of everything, field and crimson sky, burned for a moment with a transparent intensity. The question carried over the pasture and across the highway in the cotton field and returned to her clearly like an answer from beyond the wood. She opened her mouth, but no sound came out of it. Her question is its answer. As a result of all that has occurred, Mrs. Turpin is prepared to receive the revelation of the title of the story, which fittingly takes place, like that of the prodigal son, in the company of pigs. Then, like a monumental statue coming to life, she bent her head slowly and gazed, as if through the very heart of mystery, down into the pig parlor, at the hogs. They had settled all in one corner around the old sow, who was grunting softly. A red glow suffused them. Parents, could she be apprehending the whatness, the logoi of the old sow and the piglets? They appeared to pant with secret life, until the sun, parents, often the sun figures as a Eucharistic symbol in O'Connor's fiction, until the sun slipped finally behind the tree line. Mrs. Turpin remained there with her gaze bent to them as if she were absorbing some abysmal, life-giving knowledge. At last, she lifted her head. There was only a purple streak in the sky, cutting through a field of crimson and leading like an extension of the highway into the descending dusk. She raised her hands from the side of the pen in a gesture hieratic, priestly gesture, and profound. A visionary light settled in her eyes. She saw the streak as a vast swinging bridge extending upward from the earth through a field of living fire. Upon it, a vast horde of souls were rumbling toward heaven. There were whole companies of white trash, clinging for the first time in their lives, and bands of black niggers in white robes, and battalions of freaks and lunatics shouting and clapping and leaping like frogs. And bringing up the end of the procession was a tribe of people whom she recognized at once, as those who, like herself and Claude, had always had a little of everything and the God-given wit to use it right. She leaned forward to observe them closer. They were marching behind the others with great dignity, accountable as they had always been for good order and common sense and respectable behavior. They alone were on key. Yet she could see by their shocked and altered faces that even their virtues were being burned away. She lowered her hands and gripped the rail of the hog pen, her eyes small but fixed unblinkingly on what lay ahead. In a moment, the vision faded, but she remained where she was, immobile. At length, she got down and made her slow way on the darkening path to the house. In the woods around her, the invisible cricket choruses had struck up, but what she heard were the voices of the souls, climbing upward into the starry field and shouting, "Hallelujah." Could that last shout be the logoi of humans? Could it be that we exist to praise God, that that is who we truly are? Status, respectability, class, complacency, self-justification blind us to that reality. Top rail versus bottom rail isn't the ultimate configuration of human relations according to the gospel. The last shall be first and the first shall be last. Revelation may be read as an extended gloss on the parable of the Pharisee and the publican. The Pharisee who goes into the temple praying thus, "God, I thank you that I am not like other people, thieves, rogues, adulterers, or even like this tax collector. I fast twice a week. I give a tenth of all my income." But the tax collector, standing far off, would not even look up to heaven, but was beating his breast, saying, "God, be merciful to me, a sinner. I tell you, this man went down to his home justified rather than the other. For all who exalt themselves will be humbled, but all who humble themselves will be exalted." Who do you think you are? Humility is to perceive ourselves as we truly are, not inflated by grandiosity cloaked in thankfulness to God. Mrs. Turpin's gratitude to Jesus made her, quote, feel as buoyant as if she weighed 125 pounds instead of 180 pounds. That's real inflation. Nor deflated by false humility, making ourselves out to be less than we are by simply adopting the reverse image of pride.
in my life, humility, seeing myself actively, was made more difficult by the role I felt assigned to me in my family. As the favored child, the only son bearing my dead father's name and the family's future, I assumed the role of family savior. Like John Grimes, my academic success seemed to offer a way out of the neighborhoods of poverty that we lived in and the limits of white racism upon our opportunities. My academic success made my folks proud and confirmed my task as caretaker, a role reinforced by my Roman Catholicism, which led me to adopt for myself a heavy burden at an early age. As a close friend of my mother's remarked when I was 10, "Here is the little old man. I did what others wanted, and I did it well. I wanted to be a saint and to try to be not only virtuous, but perfect. In my career, the dangers of elitism and the dangers of false humility have also loomed large. How to accurately see myself as I believe to place myself in the guild of the profession, past and present, instead of entertaining the fantasy of a pioneering innovator deserving of the coveted genius award from the MacArthur Foundation. Nor will it do to disparage my accomplishments in an act of false piety that only feeds my pride. Placing myself in a common enterprise enables me to value what I do beyond my gratification or aggrandizement of myself. Let me give you an example. Several years ago, I taught a seminar on religious radicals, religion and social change in 20th century America. It was the third time I taught the course, and it seemed to me to be going badly. I had a smaller enrollment than usual, only 6 students, and they were unresponsive, especially one who hardly spoke at all until after midterm. At the very end of the semester, I learned the reason for his alienation. He had been found by the police, passed out drunk on the street, and had been arrested for possessing a false ID. He had to face the accusation of criminal behavior and the realization that he was an alcoholic. In the course, he had read 2 passages that turned his life around. One was the testimony of a black tenant farmer motivated by John Perkins, a campaign to organize poor black farmers and sharecroppers in the environs of Mendenhall, Mississippi. This alcoholic farmer had put down the bottle and stayed sober. The other text was a passage from Thomas Merton's journals on La Poivrière's, that place within where our being meets God's being, a point of innocence unavailable to the brutalities of our wills. The student entered a 12-step program, stayed sober, and was requested to speak on alcohol abuse to campus clubs. Now, I had no idea of any of this. The class was an occasion of grace. I may desire to see the effects of the good I do, but the situation is much richer and more complex than I can ever grasp. Like Mrs. Turpin, my ego gets overly invested in the results of what I do. For me, the field of living fire in O'Connor's story illustrates the surprising and liberating truth that God's mercy is incommensurate with our standards of judgment of ourselves and especially of others. It is God's mercy, not certainly my virtue, that matters. Teaching and scholarship as collaborative and communal activities may help to transform us as disciplines of doing, enabling us to understand each other and the others we study, and in understanding them, come to a more adequate understanding of ourselves. We encounter difference not as something alienating, but then as enriching. And so we are led not only to knowledge, but to compassion. The antidote to Mrs. Turpin's and our tendency to dehumanize others by classifying them, not only as others, but as pejorative others, inferior to us and those like us. This inner attitude of classification and superiority can lead quite subconsciously, as O'Connor warns, to horrific external social consequences. Sometimes Mrs. Turpin occupied herself at night naming the classes of people. Usually by the time she had fallen asleep, all the classes of people were moiling and roiling around in her head, and she would dream they were all crammed in together in a boxcar, being ridden off to be put in a gas oven. O'Connor reveals the extremes of the tendency to class ourselves as spiritually, intellectually, materially, physically, or racially superior. The subtlety of spiritual pride as the barometer of the relation of the self to others is outlined by Mark Saltzman in his novel about a cloistered Carmelite nun in Los Angeles. Solitude and community. Sister John of the Cross has been in the convent for 28 years, most of them years of spiritual dryness. She knew what it was like to feel abandoned by God. She had languished in the cloister for years, her prayers empty and her soul dry, until grace came and brought the drought to an end. For the last 3 years, she has experienced vivid visions that inspire her to write essays and poetry on the contemplative life. She is gaining a reputation as a spiritual writer. The novel opens with Sister John rising before her sisters in the early morning hours. Instead of going to the choir to wait for the others, she returned to her cell, knelt down on the floor, and unfocused her eyes. Pure awareness stripped her of everything. She became an ember carried upward by the heat of an invisible flame. Higher and higher she rose, away from all she knew. Powerless to save herself, she drifted up toward infinity until the vacuum sucked the feeble light out of her. A darkness so pure it glistened, then out of that darkness, nova. More luminous than any sun, transcending visibility, the flare consumed everything. It lit up all of existence. In this radiance, she could see forever, and everywhere she looked, she saw God's love. As soon as she could move again, she opened her notebook and began writing. Sister John has been experiencing not only visions, but suffering increasingly severe migraines. Her superior orders her to see a neurologist who determines she has temporal lobe epilepsy caused by a small benign tumor. The tumor is removable, but surgery will end her visions. Please, God, take anything. Take my life, but don't take yourself away from me. Don't tell me I haven't known you at all. I waited so long, Lord, is her poignant prayer at this point. Sister John had learned as a novice that in religious life, to gain, one had to lose everything first. The only path to victory was through surrender. To become full, one had to become empty. She had chosen to name herself after St. John of the Cross, author of The Dark Night of the Soul, which described the soul's crucifying but purifying journey away from self and toward God. Now, as a mature nun, she faces her dark night, the emptying of her desire for union with God, which she has been experiencing. She has to decide whether to have the surgery or not. This is her test of faith. And she hoped that when she faced her own dark night of the soul, she would, like her patron saint, find the strength to choose faith over despair. Her decision, however, involves not just herself. It also involves her community. She learns from Sister Miriam, a troubled novice in the community, that she is jealous of Sister John, because she and the other sisters are still searching for what Sister John has found. Mother Emmanuel, the prioress, reveals to her how disruptive her visions are to the community as a whole. Perhaps you aren't aware of yourself during those moments. Just when God offered himself to us through the Eucharist, you stood up and began wandering around the choir, staring at the ceiling and humming to yourself. Do you remember any of that? Torn by the decision, Sister John begins an all-night prayer vigil in the chapel, the site of common prayer. As she prays alone in the choir, she is joined by one sister and then another. And finally, the entire community, all holding candles, rallied to keep watch with Sister John. Their presence turned night into day, midnight sun at the end of the earth. Nothing was said, but the message was clear. A sister might feel lost, but she was never alone. Sister John chooses to have the surgery, and her visions cease. The novel ends with Mother Emmanuel asking her to take charge of training a new novice who is entering the convent. She'll need a novice mistress with a special understanding of the difficulties we face trying to do God's will, Mother Emmanuel says. When Sister John protests, "I don't feel I know anything about God's will, Mother," the prioress responds, "Yet you're still here trying to do his will anyway. That's the kind of understanding I meant. the doing kind, not the knowing kind. Self-emptying, not self-fulfillment, is the purpose of contemplative practice, silence, solitude, prayer, meditation. Religious piety can turn into a subtle spiritual pride, a form of ego gratification, when it degenerates into spiritual consumerism that focuses on having spiritual experiences to aggrandize the self. As Franny observes to Zoe in the J.D. Salinger novel, spiritual hedonism is still hedonism. Behind the drive for self-aggrandizement, whether material or spiritual, is a distorted sense of the person as an atomized ego. On the contrary, Christianity views the person as interpersonal, made in the image and likeness of God. The very purpose of our being is to commune with others in imitation of the Trinity of divine persons in whose image we are made. We stand not alone as solitary individual selves, but in compassionate solidarity with others, those who have gone before, as well as those who come after. And we stand in solidarity with our brothers and sisters in the present, especially those who suffer. In the words of St. Isaac the Syrian, a 7th century ascetic and theologian, our compassion should extend to the entire creation, for men, for birds, for animals, for demons, and for every created thing. And by the recollection and sight of them, the eyes of a compassionate man pour forth abundant tears. The contemplative tradition bears profound witness to the hidden connected of us all. The way to recognition and interpersonal responsibility, as the elders of this tradition taught, lies in the self-nodding practice of obedience, prayer, and humility, which liberate the person from the tyranny of habit and desire, from slavery to hyper-individualism that leads to isolation and despair. Solitude and community aren't antithetical, but contrapuntal. Contemplative experience in silence and solitude should not degenerate into narcissistic self-absorption, but should generate profound compassion for everyone and everything. The appeal of the contemplative life hit me at the age of 13 when I chanced upon The Seven-Story Mountain, Thomas Merton's best-selling autobiography. Merton, a Trappist monk and the foremost interpreter of the contemplative life for modern Americans, argued eloquently in a succession of spiritual classics that silence, solitude, and contemplation are necessary for a meaningful Christian life, indeed for a meaningful human life. Merton's description of the simplicity and holiness of the monastery convinced me. I wanted at the age of 13 to become a monk. And even though I dropped the idea in college, the monastic ideal he depicted had a long-lasting impact upon my life. For years, way into my maturity, career, marriage, family life, I felt a nagging doubt that somehow I had made the second best choice. I identified monastic solitude as the place of holiness and the world as the place of ordinary humdrum responsibility. Even after Merton turned in the 60s to writing trenchant social criticism of the racism, militarism, and consumerism rampant in American society, and even after I became involved in social activism and protest myself, the monk haunted the corridors of my conscience. At base, the source of this romanticized view of monasticism was, I believe, my hunger for spiritual experience. Like Sister John of the Cross, I wanted to have such experiences and secretly wanted others to know I was having these experiences. Now, to want to be viewed as a saint is hardly compatible with sanctity. I found it all too common that other people placed me upon a pedestal, but was reluctant to realize that I had internalized the pedestal. Merton insisted that the contemplative experience does not end merely in personal illumination and individual liberation. It also includes a profound realization of the unity that binds us altogether, the hidden ground of love. In awakening to our own true identity, to who we really are, we find not only ourselves, but also the world of creation of creatures and of other people, our brothers and our sisters. Only gradually have I begun to dismantle the internalized pedestal of spiritual pride. Once again, teaching and writing are the disciplines which help in this undoubtedly lifelong process. It has taken me a long time to realize that, in fact, I have chosen a contemplative vocation. Teaching and writing provide me with regular times of solitude and silence, alternating with regular periods of community. My life is counterpoised between solitary introspection and interpersonal communication. A priest friend of mine once surprised me when he advised me out of the blue, "Al, when you enter the classroom, look at the face of each of your students and love them." He opened my eyes to a dimension of teaching I had not consciously considered. Similarly, a student in a seminar I taught several years back, Spiritual Aspects of African-American Autobiography, revealed another dimension to our reading and discussion that had escaped me. During the next to last class, she described what she thought we had been doing all semester. She said, "We have been breaking apart the bread of the text and offering each other communion." Her metaphor was Eucharistic, alluding to the post-resurrection appearance of Christ to the two disciples traveling on the road to Emmaus, who recognized the stranger who was accompanying them in the breaking of the bread, a passage itself alluding to the Last Supper command of Christ to do this in memory of me. As the student continued her presentation, a murmur of approval emerged from her fellow classmates, and when she had finished, there was a small but significant burst of applause. She enabled us to recognize the holy ordinary in what we were doing. So I look back on a lifetime of researching, writing, and teaching that has stretched from Xavier in New Orleans to Yale in New Haven to University of California in Berkeley to Princeton. I am grateful for how fortunate I have been. Alas, there have been too many times when I have had the experience but missed the meaning, as T.S. Eliot puts it. Too often I've been distracted by impatience and pride and the need to know the outcome of my efforts. Too often I've been looking elsewhere, desiring to escape the here and now and the hard work of tending to daily responsibilities and complex relationships in search of a holy life of spiritual experience. But every now and then, more frequently than I expect, I glimpse the holy ordinary and am moved to agree with St. Thérèse of Lisieux, another Carmelite nun, that grace is everywhere.